Well, I'd say I survived, or you survived, but we survived. We survived 3 months. We've survived the United Kingdom. For me, it's been an edifying study. It's been a great opportunity. I appreciate the elders volunteering me to do this. I think that sometimes you need the kind of the push, and it's not that I'm against it, but sometimes you just think about the amount of work it takes and you just get tired just thinking about it. And so the fact that I was booked way out in advance, but the fact that I was given the opportunity and the encouragement to do so, I appreciate that. It's made it so much greater that everybody here has participated. I said at the beginning, I'm a conversationalist. I want conversation. I want back and forth. I appreciate the comments. I appreciate the debate, the arguments. We could talk about that. I appreciate the comments after class or the email on extra material, that sort of stuff. I've really appreciated it. So thank y'all, and hopefully this was something that built y'all up, helped your Bible knowledge, helped encourage you as we have been studying these last 3 months. I do want to say thank you that she's not here, but Melissa, this is, you know, anytime you hunker down for this amount of time to teach 25 or 26 classes in this amount of time, it's rough with family and kids, but it's a good opportunity also for our family and for the kids to understand that this is integral in our lives, and it's integral in yours to sit down and study the Bible, and to let your family see you study the Bible is important as well. The other people who aren't here, and they may never know this, I talked to them about it, but for you to know, because I think it would have been encouraging to you, is I'm thankful for Dean and Wayne. So I work for Christians, and I've been afforded any opportunity I need to prep for this class. I've been given time off if I needed it. I've been given time off early on Wednesdays, a little bit earlier than I normally get off, to be able to make sure that I'm here, I'm prepped, I'm ready to go. I got to say, that's been extremely helpful, and I'm very grateful for that, and I think that that's commendable for Christians who understand the idea of we have work, and we should be doing work, and we have an employer-employee relationship, but the fact that they're willing, as Christians, to give me the opportunity to study so that I can do the best that I can to teach the Word is important as well, and I'm grateful for them, and I think that's important for y'all to know, that that's been something on the back end that y'all don't see, members of another congregation here locally, that they're helping in this as well. So I wanted to make that mention as well. We're in 1 Kings 11, and I have 11 on the schedule, but it's 11 and 12 as we get into the breakup of the year of the United Kingdom. It will be no more after this class. We're going to get into what happened to Solomon. And it's interesting how the United Kingdom lays out. We have, you know, X amount of chapters for Saul, but the bulk of it's about David, and then we don't have but 12 chapters really about Solomon. Though each king reigned for 40 years. And so it's interesting, and we only get, you know, a chapter and a half about Solomon and the downfall of the kingdom because of what he did. So it's important to understand in this class, we've talked about David especially because it was the reaffirming a covenant, the covenant that he made with Abraham, and then making a covenant with David that, you know, there would be one to come that would reign on high, that would bless the nation. It's important that's integral to David's storyline. You know, this is written in the lens of we're trying to get from Genesis 3 to, you know, a Messiah coming, the salvation of mankind, the blessing of every man. And so the Bible's written in that way. So we have a focus in on these stories for a purpose and a reason. So lesson 24, 1 Kings 11, we see a shift in the narrative. You know, so Solomon, we finished up with him building the temple. We've talked about the economic status of the nation. We've talked about the notoriety of Israel, the greatness of Solomon, his wisdom, his knowledge, how it's known worldwide. And then we get to this first section here, which is a shift. You know, the tone shifts and what's about to happen to this world power right now. So I ask the question as we look at chapter 11 of 1 Kings 1 through 8. Why was Solomon's love for Pharaoh's daughter and the women of Moab, Ammon, Edom, Sidon, and Hittite a problem?
He turned his heart away from the Lord to worship their gods.
So he turned their heart away from the Lord to worship their gods. It's interesting here when it talks about in verse 1, it says the king. Now King Solomon loved many foreign women along with the daughter of Pharaoh. Now, that might mean that he loved them differently. It might mean he loved all these women along with Pharaoh, his daughter, who indications are she was one of his first wives. Or I kind of took it more along the lines of in addition to. she's lumped in with, the idea that she's one of these foreign women that we learn about who turned his heart away. It's interesting how the wording goes. You look at the new, the ESV also says along with, but the NIV says besides, or as well as, is what the New King James says, or together with. So, does it lump her in with the rest of the people? She's specified. She's singled out, or does it single her out as maybe being separate? To me, it lends itself to maybe she was one of the foreign women who might have helped turn him away, knowing that Egyptians were of an idolatrous nature as well. But it was just an interesting tidbit there. As you read, it's important to read those things because those phrases may mean different things in different contexts. The idea of along with.
Yes? Back to 1 Kings 3.
1 Kings 3.
There is this woman heard it.
Yes.
And at this time, and following chapter 3, his heart was fully devoted to God.
Okay.
There's no indication that the daughter of Pharaoh had any negative effect on him at that time.
Okay, so that was 1 Kings 3:1. It says Solomon formed a marriage alliance with Pharaoh, and he took Pharaoh's daughter and brought her up to the city of David until he finished building the house earlier in his reign. And
you see down in verse 3, the writer says he followed the Lord's book at that point. And then, of course, you have the building of the temple, the dedication of the temple, all of which is pleasing to God. So, maybe, chapter 11, that's why she's set apart from the other women.
Mm-hmm.
Along with her, he had these foreign women.
Yeah.
That would explain why she's, as you've noted, seems to be separated a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And so possibly she became a proselyte to Jewish religion. That's why you read nothing about her turning his heart away from chapter 3 on.
And you don't see anything in 4, 5, 6, and 7 where it talks about he built her any idols, he built her any temples or anything like that. It's one of those things that, having studied it and written the questions and then going back and looking at it, it's a different point of view. And it's a good thing to look at from the standpoint of Solomon was faithful during the times that he was married, Pharaoh being one of his first wives. And the fact that maybe she had become a proselyte and been part of the she turned to God. And so when I wrote the question, it was intended that, you know, that she was lumped in. But I wanted to present both sides because there is evidence to maybe indicate that she wasn't, and that's why she's separate in this context. Yes, ma'am.
The fact still was that he moved her to her house and everything because he didn't leave her in the city of David where the ark had gone through.
Mm-hmm.
And so, she's still a foreign woman.
She's still a foreign woman. Which is what we're getting to. So it's regardless of what they were doing, and this is focusing on Solomon, what Solomon did. He allowed something to happen. It was an interesting tidbit. I don't want to spend too much time on it, but that Pharaoh's daughter may not have been one of the women who turned him aside. Whether she was or it wasn't is of no consequence, because what did he do? I asked in question 2, what did God warn against back in Exodus 34 and Deuteronomy 7 and Joshua 23? Don't marry the women of other nations. Specifically, that was what I was looking for. Intermarrying, and he warned about what it could lead to. There's things about following my commands, my ordinances, and don't play the harlot, and don't be idolaters. But the idea, specifically because of what we're dealing with, is don't intermarry. Did the warning faze Solomon, and how do we know? And this is one of those that I probably didn't word very well, but you answer the way you choose.
He did not.
He did not? Okay.
So
I agree with both of you because I wrote the question with what Sandra had in mind is that he didn't heed the warning. But on the other hand, as I redid the lesson and was looking over it, he did for a time. He was obedient. It was only when he got old that he didn't. So if it was a yes or no, he didn't. The warning didn't faze him. But really, he was faithful to God until he got older. So I would say that he did heed the warning for a little while. And then we know that he turned away. How do we know? It tells us here. It tells us in the scripture. It says when he got old that he turned away. He started building, you know, all these other places, and he started worshiping other gods. He wasn't fully devoted to God. How is Solomon's heart described in verse 4? His heart was not wholly devoted to God. It's interesting that he worded it that way, or at least it was to me. What are your thoughts on that? So that's the question. And we'll get there in a second. That's interesting to me. This was the conundrum in my head. He's not wholly devoted to God, but either you are God is number one, or he's nothing at all to you. I mean, God said you'll have no other gods before me. He's not taking second place. You're either devoted to God or you aren't. But it says he's not wholly devoted to God. So what?
He's not loyal
to the Lord God. Okay, not loyal. New King James. Your reference says complete with. ASV and King James says not perfect with. The ESV says not wholly true. What is, to me, what would the writer try to indicate? And that's what I think Don was talking about here. What did you say, Don? You forget?
Yeah.
Don said that he wasn't divided. His heart was divided. Okay, I think that's what the context is trying to indicate to us, that his heart was divided. The interesting thing is you're either devoted to God or you're not. We see this because God was angry with him. So your brain goes on tangents, and this is a tangent that's applicable, but you know, how did he go from here to there? You know, you read this context and it says when he was old, his wives turned his heart away from God, and his heart was not wholly devoted to God. So how do you divide your heart between God? How do you divide your heart between these other idols? For the sake of time, I will give you a thought process for, you know, some things that are going on today. So Solomon married these foreign women. And at first, he's wholly devoted to God. But these women, you know, you think about it. Maybe they're constantly talking about their gods, their idols, their this, their that. You know, we're living in an age of tolerance. So I'm okay with that. I'm going to do my thing. You're going to do your thing. Well, just come with me. Just come, you know, build me this just so I can worship my God. You don't have to persist. But, well, come with me. Just be there while I join me on my journey to the temple so that I can, you know, well, just you can be there. Sit with me. And I'm not saying, you know, we're getting ready to talk about world religions. Where's Doug? He's going to talk about world religions. I'm not saying that you can't go and sit in a non-denominational church or go sit in a Baptist or a Methodist church and hear somebody preach. But, you know, there's going to be a breakover point where, you know, you're going to cross a line. Where's that line? Something that struck me as I was studying, you know, when did he turn his heart away, or maybe how that happened? You think about that slippery slope. And I'm not saying again that you can't go to another assembly and listen to somebody preach. I'm not saying you can't go to another assembly and sing songs of praise to God. I'm not saying that's wrong. But it's interesting to me in Exodus 34 and in Numbers 25, in the warnings that God gives, it says, and someone might invite you to eat his sacrifice. That's what Exodus 34:15. Numbers 25:2, it says, they invite the people to the sacrifices of their gods, and the people ate and bowed down to their gods. Is that like, is the oxen on the altar like the gateway to the being hardcore idolatrous? I joke about it, but you know, you think about it, and it got me to thinking about this slippery slope. Look over at 1 Corinthians 10 for a second. Maybe I'll be able to articulate this thought for everyone. Sometimes we'll use this passage to help understand that when we have fellowship with partaking the Lord's Supper, it's who we have fellowship with. We have fellowship with God. In this context, though, it's Paul writing to the Corinthians. And he says, therefore, my beloved, flee from idolatry. That's what he's talking about. I speak to you as wise men. You judge what I say. Is not the cup of blessing which we bless a sharing in the blood of Christ? Is not the bread which we break a sharing in the body of Christ? And we talk about this in the standpoint of Paul's not there with them. So he's not physically partaking with them. He is sharing in the fact that they are both partaking of these emblems. And so what are they sharing in? They're both partaking and having fellowship with God. And so they are sharing this experience in the sense that I don't need that person next to me to partake, but we are both worshiping God. Okay. So as you continue on, since there is no one bread, we who are many are one body. for we all partake of one bread. Here he goes, talking about the nation of Israel. Look at the nation of Israel. Are not those who eat the sacrifices sharers in the altar? Not sharing with one another, sharing in the worship. Because that's what he's talking about in 16 and 17. What do I mean then? That a thing sacrificed to idols is anything, or that an idol is anything? It's just meat. It's just a lump of stone or a lump of wood. No, but I say that the things which a Gentile sacrifice, they sacrifice to demons and not to God. And I do not want you to become sharers in the demons. So when you partake of that sacrifice, and it's an act of worship for them, you're sharing in that act of worship. You're sharing and having fellowship with that demon or that idol. Or, you know, that meat doesn't necessarily mean anything. Those emblems that we partake of don't necessarily mean anything, but they represent something. And so you can look at other passages, because there are other passages that talk about eating meat sacrificed to idols, and it's okay. That's not in the context of worship. Go to Romans 14, which is not really Romans 14. It's in this context, 1 Corinthians 8, talking about it's okay to eat meat sacrificed to idols. It's just meat, but don't do it to harm your brother's conscience. Not in the context of worship. It's once the meat has been sacrificed, they sell it. It's in a restaurant or whatever. It's not like it's soaked in, like through osmosis, this blessing. It's not like it's got this blessing hanging over it after it's been sacrificed. It's just food. It's in the context of worship. So where am I going with this? In today's time, we have, and I know people who do this, you know, a lot of congregations have gone to morning services. We don't have near as much shift work, and so you do 9, 10, and 11, get out at noon. And then they may want to go meet up with friends, and so, hey, I'm going to go to 5 o'clock worship service with them at a non-denominational or another congregation. All right? I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that if you're trying to understand or you're trying to teach or have an impact on somebody. But you need to be careful, because let's say I go to that congregation. I can sit and listen to a preacher preach. But if they have a band and they start singing with the band, and hey, you know, they're going to play Vince Gill's, you know, Go Rest High on That Mountain, which has some kind of religious feel and connotation. Oh, I sing that on the radio all the time. I'll sing with them, not as a form of worship. It's not what I'm thinking of as a form of worship, but they're worshiping. We're not partaking in that worship like I would have been partaking of that meat sacrificed to idols. You know, when I decide to start to partake in their worship service, I'm devoted to God, but I'm going to do this over here just because, you know, I don't want to hurt their feelings. You've divided yourself. We should guard ourselves against. I'm not saying you close yourself off. You need to be able to defend your faith and to deal with these types of issues. But you got to be careful not to put God second, not to be so tolerant or to be so easily acquiescing to other people's thoughts and their wants or needs that you sacrifice your morals and your beliefs and your God. He is a jealous God. That's my tangent. But that's, you know, you think about how Solomon may have slowly drifted away. And I'm not saying it did slowly drift away. It does say as he was older, his heart turned away. But you see what he did. He wound up building other things, idols, places of worship for these women. How did that happen? I don't think it happened all at one time. Yes, sir.
God, and if you read historically about that God they worship, it was human sacrifices. They worshiped with orgies. They did all types of detestable things to worship this God, this false God. And for him to build that temple for them really shows how far the influence they had on him and how they really turned away his heart totally away from God.
I mean, it says right here, Malcolm the detestable idol. Let's say Solomon's just building this for these women for him. I'm gonna build you a place of worship. It's no consequence to me, but you're building a house of worship to another God. Are you not dividing yourself, or should you not be trying to teach of, you know, the one true and living God versus these idols? It got me to thinking. The way that's worded, not wholly devoted to the Lord, how easily we can be divided, how easily we can split, how easily we can turn away. Yes, ma'am.
Take that to the next step.
Yes, ma'am.
Not changing your interest as far as worship, but completely falling away from any worship. It can be done so easy. Little bit by little bit.
It can. Slowly but surely, you can, if you don't continually devote your heart toward God, live for God. You know, what do? You continually study His commands, His ordinances, His statutes. If we don't do that, then our heart can slowly be chipped away by this world around us, by our friends, the people who have impacts on us. And they do. They have an impact on us. Here's the wisest man who God appeared to twice, who allowed his heart to be turned away, allowed his heart to be drifted. I mean, he wrote part of Proverbs. He's smart. He's the most wise man in the world. And this is what happened to him.
Verse 9, to me, shows that he, to be wholly devoted or not wholly devoted doesn't mean that you can have one foot in the Lord's temple and the other in an idol's temple, like you were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
God was angry because he turned away. It wasn't just, I'm going to worship God a little bit and then I'm going to build all these things. Turned away from God.
And that's verse 9. He did turn his heart away from it. Like at the beginning, it says he wasn't wholly devoted to, and I wanted to, that phrase is interesting to me because either you're devoted to God or you're not, because he requires full devotion. He was turned away, and I don't want to take away from that because I don't want to say that Solomon was like, oh, I'm just going to help out. No, it says here that for Solomon went after Ashtaroth, the goddess of Sidians, and Malcolm, the detestable. He went after them. He did, he did those things. But it just got me to thinking about how we can slide over here and be tolerant, or just, I'm going to do this over here, but God still loves me, and he's my number one, but I'm going to still kind of dabble over here just because my friends do it, or because I enjoy it a little bit, but I'm making sure that I'm here on my Sundays and Wednesdays, and I'll check that off because that's what I'm supposed to be doing, but then this over here is extra. So, all right, let's move on. If you have any more questions about what I've said, I've got 25 minutes and you're done with me, so let's move on. All right, so Solomon turns away from the Lord. And why was God angry? Well, because Solomon's heart was turned away. What does God say he had done for Solomon twice? We've talked about this too. What has he done? He appeared to him twice. You know, the expectation for us is to read this Bible and to have a faith and to be obedient to God. Much greater of a faith should Solomon have if God had appeared to him. I mean, you think about that. Vice versa. Okay, God appeared to him twice. Did it make his faith any greater than ours? We don't need God to appear to us because there are so many times that God appeared to perform miracles in front of these people and they still turned away. I don't need those miracles because those miracles don't save me. And just because they've been formed to me, they may convict me for a time, but that doesn't mean I have to have them, because you see people turning away from that. People will say, it would be easier to live in the time of Christ when he was performing the miracles, or the time of Moses, or when the time of these things were being done. People were still fell away. It's a matter of our hearts. It's a matter of their hearts. I mean, we think it would be easier to see it, but how many people do we see fall away even though they've seen those things? So, to me, that's a lesson to be learned as well. How much greater of a faith should he have had? But I don't have to have those things because it ultimately didn't do anything for him. He was willing to turn his heart away. What was God's punishment on Solomon? And my question was it really a punishment? He tore the kingdom away from him. Can you be more specific, or somebody else? He would give it to his servant. All right. So it wouldn't be right away. So Solomon turns away from God. And so God says, well, I'm going to take the kingdom from you. But I'm not going to do it right now. I'm going to take it away from you after you're gone. I'm going to give it to your servant. Is that punishment? I mean, am I going to go wait till Sean does something bad now? So I'm going to wait until he's, 22, 23, or I'll wait till he's 30. Let's hope he doesn't have 5 or 6 year old until he's 30. If I'm waiting, I'm going to spank his 5 and 6 year old then. Like, Sean, your punishment is I'm going to spank your 5 or 6 year old, 25 years down the line. Is that punishment?
You don't think about the king and a diamond.
And that's the point. Because that's what you think about this. How was it a punishment? So elaborate on that, Graham. That's it. That was my thought process too. Was it a punishment? What are y'all's thoughts?
Did he delay it because of David?
He did delay it because of David, but from the standpoint of punishment, I was looking at it from that standpoint. He delayed it for David because of his love for David. He wouldn't do it in this lifetime. He would do it after. But how would this be a punishment? So I've brought it up. I think it would be a punishment. How would it be a punishment? To Solomon.
Well, he knows his kingdom is going to be taken away from his son. God said, that is a punishment.
Okay, so his kingdom's going to be taken away from his son. Well, I mean, what does that matter? It's not going to happen to him.
The promise
was through David. I think about his legacy, and I think the family impact. How that you know, he's the ruler of one of the greatest world powers. I mean, nothing's ever been seen like what the temple was. He rules over this nation. How is this a punishment? His name and his reputation are tarnished. He's turned away from God, the deity who's gotten him that. It's because of God that all this has happened. Now he's not going to be remembered like David, but he's going to be a cautionary tale of those who come after him. His dynasty is going to crumble, and his legacy is going to be that one who doesn't follow God. He's not going to be a David who has. I mean, you see in Acts, is it Stephen's sermon or somewhere in Acts? It's either in 7 or in 13. One of those it talks about David. It talks about him being a man after God's own heart. Even all those years later, 1,000 years later, they're all talking about David and what kind of a man he was and how he loved God. Solomon, on the other hand, is a cautionary tale. You know, his dynasty is not what he built it up to be. The greatest of the great in the world. Now, that's not what it is. You can also think about the family impact. You know, you think about, if you don't have kids, you think about maybe how it relates to your spouse or your you know, other family members around you that you love. You know, knowing that your kid is going to go through something like that, that the nation is going to be taken away from him. And though Rehoboam was going to wind up with one tribe, how are we going to get from point A to point B? And what Solomon had known had come before, what bloodshed might happen, what impact might it have on other family members of Rehoboam or of him. You don't know. I mean, the family impact. You don't know what your kids are going to face, what difficulties. You're not going to know. You know, the thing that you worked hard for and you cultivated will not be passed on as intended. You know that your children will not know of your shortcomings and your weaknesses and your vices, as opposed to, you know, here's what I've accomplished. It's going to be look what I lost because I allowed, you know, myself to turn away from God, not be devoted to the deity, the one true and living God who got me to this point. So is it a punishment? I would say so, and I think that's the way you could look at it. His dynasty is going to fall apart.
I don't know if it's a good parallel, Keith.
Yes, sir.
But it may give us a little taste of it. Suppose the president was said, when we told Mr. Clinton, there's not going to be a Clinton library. All we're going to do is put a monument up, kind of like your affair with Monica Lewinsky, no presidential library.
Mm-hmm.
This is what people are going to remember about you. How would that affect?
Yeah, I mean, what kind of an impact would that have on me? We're just going to remember the bad things about you, not the good things. It weighs on you. And we live in a different time and age than then. But, I mean, Solomon, known world renowned for all everything. It has an impact. So, let's see. Susan, I think, already answered this, but why did God delay punishment? Why didn't he take the entire kingdom away? Okay, so because of King David, is that... And Jerusalem. What else could be in view as he is not taking the entire kingdom away?
Christ coming through Judah.
So you've got this covenant with David in view, but, you know, he's also... keeping intact, you know, the lineage that through which Christ would come through, this messianic prophecy that has been made. It's interesting as you trace that line through how where Jesus came through, how the nation of Israel, you know, ebbed to and fro, and you know, Judah down to, you know, you read the book of Esther, the providence of God there, and, you know, the nation was hanging by a thread, or the Jewish people were hanging by a thread, and how it came through. That's something else that you could look at as to why God delayed punishment. It says because of the covenant with David, but you can see in view maybe the messianic prophecy as well, the providence of God. I put in here that God keeps his word. He made a promise to David, and he keeps the promise. So as we continue on into 14 through 40, So it says, the Lord raised up an adversary to Solomon, and answered the question, how did the adversaries of Solomon come to be? Well, the Lord raised them up. Does that mean that God said, you and you and you, or what does that mean? He allowed it to happen. I mean, he allowed it to happen, but we also see with Jeroboam that, you know, he had a prophet come to him. Either way, the Lord raised them up. It was his will that it would happen. So, what adversaries of Solomon, who were the adversaries of Solomon, and give a brief description as to, or an explanation as to why they rose up. Not all at one time.
Hadad
the Edomite. And what would you surmise? It wasn't plainly spoken, but what would we surmise would be the reason why he rose up? I don't know that there's a wrong answer here. I kind of gathered some information based on what was said about him. That's what I was thinking. The royal line. It says that he's of the royal line in verse 1. I mean, in verse 1. In verse 14, he was of the royal line of Edom. And so, Joab, the commander of the army, had buried and slain and struck down all the males of Edom. But when he found out that they were dead, he decides he wants to go back to his own country. He'd been in Egypt, wants to go back to his home country. Maybe to reestablish his, you know, gain back his throne, his country, his kingdom. So the idea that this was what is driving him, this is why he rises up. Who else rose up? Who?
Jeroboam.
Jeroboam. We'll stop. Who's the one between? Because there's more to say about him. Reason, the son of Eliad, and why did he rise up? Well, what do you surmise from that?
He seemed like a rebel. He had fled from his lord, and then he got a marauding band, where Hadad had a personal issue because all the males of Edom had been killed. And mm-hmm. He escaped with the boy, so when he was grown, David's dead, I'm going back.
And so it's interesting because I didn't want to say vengeance for Hadad. He's got the royal line. He's been run out of the country, but he's after getting back to his country. Maybe raising up. But is there some vengeance there? All these young men have been killed. All these babies have been killed. Whereas with Razan, it says he fled from his lord. He gathered men to himself and became a leader of the marauding band after David slew them of Zobah, and they went to Damascus and stayed there and reigned in Damascus. So he was an adversary to Israel. I wondered if maybe he was after vengeance. He was a marauder. He was kind of a pirate. He was, you know, he wandered around and thieved and plundered and that sort of stuff. And so, not that what Hadad did was any more, was any better, but maybe it had a little bit more, I don't know what the word would be. It wasn't as bad, I don't know. Maybe.
There's a call. Joab had killed all those males in Edom. And so now he's a grown man.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going back to give him trouble.
So would you say that would be vengeance, or you say he wants to gain back his country versus over here he's just upset about what happened? I mean, he's talking about being of the royal line. I don't know that it really matters. There are adversaries, but for years of my understanding, conversation, debate. There you go. There's no right or wrong answer to this, I don't think. Raisin is on verse 25. The evil that Hadad did, but I mean, was Hadad doing evil? What was his purpose in doing evil? I guess it's kind of what my thoughts were. He did it so he could gain back the status and gain back his land, to gain back his heritage. I don't know, just for the purpose of the class, it's interesting as to these people, God allowing these people to rise up. Like I said, I don't know that there's a right or wrong answer as you put the information together, but it's interesting that you have these two rise up, but then you have who? Susan, who we have?
Jeroboam.
Now we have Jeroboam, so why did he rise up?
He was a servant of Solomon.
He was a servant of Solomon, but why did he rise up? It was the will of God. So God rose up these adversaries, and you've got these two men, for whatever reason that God allowed to rise up. You know, they did evil. They were bad people. These are his people. But you also have Jeroboam, who rises up, who was a servant of Solomon. And he said he was a valiant warrior in 28. And when Solomon saw the young man was industrious, he appointed him over the forced labor of the house of Joseph. Now, we've talked about this. You know, Solomon seemed to be tough on the nation of Israel, but we'll read about that in just a second. And then here you have Jeroboam. Maybe this part of the reason why he was picked, because, you know, people would rally behind him for this purpose. But he was put over the forced labor of the house of Joseph. But it was because God's will that he wanted him to rise up. He had this prophet come to him and tell him that, you know, you were going to verse 31. He said to Jeroboam, excuse me, take for yourself 10 pieces, for thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, behold, I will tear the kingdom of the hand of Solomon and give you 10 tribes. But he will have one tribe for the sake of my servant David, and from the sake of Jerusalem, the city which I have chosen from all the tribes of Israel. Because they have forsaken me and have worshipped Ashtaroth the goddess. Goes on to say that, but he says, and they have not walked in my ways, done what is right in my sight, and observing my statutes and my ordinances, as his father David did. God's going to allow him to rise up because of what Solomon's done. And he's going to take those 10 tribes because of what Solomon done. So these were the adversaries. Has God set a precedent for... Well, hold on. Let me back up for a second. Ask questions or comments first before we kind of... That's kind of a different train of thought. On the adversaries and them rising up. All right. It says, I asked a question, has God set a precedent for judging his people with those from within and without? Sure, he has. We look at the book of Judges and how God continually judged or punished his people because they were playing the harlot. We see again that Israel and that Judah were both punished or judged because of they were playing the harlot. He has set a precedent that he will do that. They're his people, but... And just like kids need to be disciplined, so did these people. And the nation, Solomon, should have known better. What was told to Jeroboam in verse 38 and 39? Same thing we've been talking about the entirety of this United Kingdom. That if you listen to all the command and you walk in my ways, you do what is right in my sight by observing my statutes, my commands, as my servant David, then I will... be with you and build you an enduring house as I built for David. If you do these things, same recipe every single time. Did Solomon try to escape his fate? Yes, he tried to kill Jeroboam. Should he have known that that wasn't going to work? Yes, he's the wisest man on earth. Should have known if it was God's will for Jeroboam to rise up that he wasn't going to be able to kill him. Solomon's death. We see that in 1 Kings 12, 1 through 20. How long did Solomon reign? 40 years. So we had 40-ish years for Saul. We have 40 years for David. We have 40 years for Solomon, depending on some of the timelines you look at. Who was his successor? Rehoboam rises up and takes the kingdom. So now we move into a different story, and we move into this punishment coming to fruition. Who went before Rehoboam, and what was implored? Jeroboam and all the Israel, all the assembly of Israel. What did he implore? What did he want him to do? Lighten the load. This kind of hearkening back to that forced labor thing. Jeroboam being over the house of Joseph. We talked about that before, how hard Solomon might have been on them to build all these things, and though that was a prerogative of the king they wanted. Who did Rehoboam consult with, and what was the counsel?
His young friends.
Is that the only people he consulted with?
The elders.
So we got two different factions. So what did the elders say?
Lighten the load.
Lighten their load. He says, if I remember right, it says, be a servant to them. If you will be a servant to these people today and will serve them and grant them their petition and speak good words to them, then they will be your servants forever. What did these young people who grew up with Rehoboam tell him?
Add to your yoke.
I'm gonna be tougher, my dad. I'm gonna make it that much harder. Yeah, discipline with scorpions as opposed to discipline with whips. I don't know, maybe trying to make his mark, make a name for himself. I mean, I thought Solomon had done fairly well for himself. I think that, but sometimes we talk about the entitlement part of this. You know, be a good leader is to be a good servant and to live the life of a servant and to, you know, be dedicated to the people and to God. So he heeded the young men. And what was the result of heeding the young men's advice or counsel? Split the kingdom. There we are. Kingdom is split. What insight does verse 15 give us? That's right. For it was a turn of events from the Lord. This wouldn't have happened had the Lord not wanted it to happen. But the Lord judged Solomon. He made it so. So this is a turn of events from the Lord. He allowed it to happen. Doesn't mean he forced it to happen. They have free will, but it was a turn of events of the Lord. What is said in verse 16? Have we heard this before? Still got this rift between Israel and Judah. You see it back in Sheba's revolt. Now you see it here again. It kind of rears its ugly head. Ask the question. We're running close to time. Ask the question, give some reasons as to why there might be the underlying rift between Israel and Judah. And so I'll give you mine. One of the ones that I got to thinking about was 2 Samuel 16. The idea that David maybe usurped the throne from Saul. You think about Shimei. And that's what he kind of says when they're running him out of town. That, you know, because of your bloodshed and all this is going to be heaped back on you because all your bloodshed on the house of Saul. That was the underlying rift between Israel and Judah. Or 2 Samuel 19, you look at maybe David being of Judah. And maybe Israel, the nation of Israel, resents that. You know, he's of Judah versus these other 10 tribes. They talk about when they bring him back as king that we have 10 parts to him, you have one. But he is of the nation of Judah. Or maybe, and this is what I lend itself to more than anything else, is that, you know, the idea that Israel rejected God, not that Judah was much better in the long run, but the idea that these people rejected God as king and did what was right in their own eyes. Maybe this was the rift. You know, that was the rift that was going on, that Israel continually, it seemed like over and over, was rejecting God. Those are some reasons. Am I right or wrong? I can't tell you that. But just a thought as to maybe why. Lastly, what nations were formed because of the split and who ruled them? Who are the divided kingdom? Okay, Jeroboam over Israel and Rehoboam over Judah. And that's the United Kingdom study. Appreciate your comments. I appreciate your support. Neil, you're good.